Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oye, oye, oye. The Supreme Court hands down another big campaign finance decision. General Motors and its brand and our series, The Secret Life of a Food Stamp. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdahl. There's a limit on how much you, an individual, can give to a single candidate running for office, $2,600. And on top of that, there had been limits on how much you could give overall. I say had because today, the U.S. Supreme Court said those overall limits are unconstitutional. So theoretically, you could give $2,600 to each and every candidate nationwide, and also to political parties. Here's Marketplace's Mark Garrison on what today's decision could mean.
Let's meet two folks on two sides of this issue who both filed briefs with the court. Ilya Shapiro of the Libertarian Cato Institute is happier of the pair.
The Supreme Court should free up the arena for political speech.
Trevor Potter is with Campaign Legal Center. You may have seen him on TV in his role as lawyer for Stephen Colbert's many satirical political ventures. The court did not agree with him.
If they read our brief, they apparently didn't care about the consequences.
This is Marketplace, not Legal Place, so we won't dwell on their arguments. In short, Potter worries about money causing corruption. Shapiro says restricting campaign spending restrains free speech. But there's one place they agree. First, Potter.
I think there will be a net increase in the amount of money going into politics.
And Shapiro.
I think there will be increased contributions in general to the candidates and campaigns.
And it may mean less money given to outside groups. In recent years, dollars have flowed from billionaires to super PACs and 501c4s. Outside money has been the trendy thing in campaigns, but this ruling may bring a vintage political force back into style. Scott Bland is with National Journal Hotline, a news source for political insiders.
It's possible that as a result of this, the parties will be able to exercise a little bit more influence than they have over the last few years.
In a political environment full of new ways to spend money, today's ruling may help empower a very old one. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The CEO of General Motors, Mary Barra, spent another day on Capitol Hill testifying before lawmakers about why it took GM a decade to recall millions of cars with defective ignition switches. Barra apologized again today, but as the recall continues, it's unclear what'll happen to the automaker's brand. David Vinjamori is the author of the book Accidental Branding, and it's good to have you here.
Thank you, David.
David, you're someone who pays close attention to brands, and I wonder sort of what you make of how GM has handled it in light of all of this.
I've actually been surprised at how well Mary Barra, as a new CEO, has done with this. It's the worst imaginable job to walk into. One of the most visible CEOs in the U.S., you come in and uncover a major, major issue that leads to an enormous recall, and the transparency and honesty and forthrightness, I think, has been very helpful, although obviously GM itself is in a difficult position.
Talk to me about its brand. I mean, this is a company that was in bankruptcy a few years ago. It had to rely on the federal government to get out of that. So you could say that its brand has sort of clawed back to what it was. How badly does this tarnish it?
You know, it's hard to say because it depends on whether, and you could hear it in the testimony, it depends on whether this is attributed to the old GM or to the new GM. And that's really the way that she was trying to position it. If people see this as a part and parcel of the company that went bankrupt, and they see her as a CEO coming in to clean that up, I think it'll be good for the brand. If it is seen as a continuing morass, it will not be good.
The risk here, I assume, is that you'll have Americans thinking about buying cars who are going to pause, maybe give second thought to buying a GM vehicle. How does a company get around that when news like this is broken and the story's still unfolding?
You know, it's a shame because they actually have some very solid products that have been coming out in the last couple of years. And I think the best thing that they can do is basically what she did today. You apologize. You're transparent. You say, this is what we're doing. We're working with the U.S. attorney. They've brought on one of the top victims' compensations expert in the country to show that they're serious about actually taking care of the people who were affected by this.
Yeah, they've brought on Kenneth Feinberg, who a lot of us will know the name from the 9/11 fund, from after the massacre at Virginia Tech, and from the BP oil spill. What do you make of that decision? This is them getting ahead of things here. Why do you think that they hired Ken Feinberg?
Well, they clearly hired him because they wanted to signal that they were quite serious in doing the right thing by the victims. And it's actually, I have to say, it's surprising for a CEO only this far into the job and for a recall at this moment. I think it really does signal that they want to get this past them as quickly as possible.
Any advice that you would want to offer to Mary Barra as she continues to look into this and continues to talk about it?
When you're in that CEO position, you're getting a lot of contradictory advice, and a lot of it has to do with the financial implications. Well, if I admit that we made a mistake, how many more zeros is that going to add to compensation? And you can't think about that, because what you really actually have to do is say, if I do right by my customers, if I do right by the people who depend on this to transport their children, then they will eventually pay me back. It's the only way to look at these things when you're in the midst of a crisis.
David Vinciamori is the author of the book Accidental Branding. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Markets today up all the way across. Details when we do the numbers. To New York now, where the state's education department says it'll no longer store any student data with a nonprofit called In Bloom. That makes New York the last big customer to drop out of an initiative to track student data that was backed by a number of nonprofits, including the Gates Foundation. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott looks at the implications here on the future of big data.
States and school districts collect a trove of information about their students. In Bloom was created to store and use that data to help those students learn. Paige Kowalski is with the Data Quality Campaign. She says one example might be an early warning system.
We don't need to wait anymore for a child to be a junior in high school before we can take a look back and understand if they're ready to go to college. We can know much earlier.
Like as early as fourth grade. The data could alert teachers and parents when a student is falling off track and allow them to intervene. So what kind of data are we talking about?
It included names, addresses, emails, phone numbers, grades, test scores, disabilities.
That's Leonie Hameson with Class Size Matters in New York. Her group has been fighting to block the state from working with In Bloom over concerns those personal details could fall into the wrong hands or be shared with for-profit vendors. Kenneth Couquier is data editor of The Economist and co-author of a new e-book on big data in education. He says all that information is already out there, but districts are storing it on antiquated systems that are less secure.
In Bloom was the solution to this. Its purpose was to protect privacy.
It's not clear what's next for In Bloom. Of the 9 states initially on board, just Illinois remains as a partner. The state is giving its districts the choice of working with the nonprofit. An In Bloom official says the group is still talking with individual school districts around the country. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And I'll say in the interest of full disclosure, Marketplace does receive financial support from the Gates Foundation. Charles Keating died this week. He was the poster boy for one of the worst financial crises of the last few decades, the savings and loan scandal in the late 80s. Back then, more than 1,000 banks went bankrupt, and taxpayers bailed them out at a cost of more than $100 billion. Maybe that sounds familiar. It takes you back, I don't know, 2008? Well, Marketplace's Dan Weissman takes us down memory lane, or I should say, bad memory lane.
William Black teaches law at the University of Missouri. But in the 1980s, he was a banking regulator, Charles Keating's banking regulator. In the time since, he's written a book. It's called The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He says Keating was a product of his environment. That environment was characterized by what Black calls the 3 Ds.
Deregulation, desupervision, and de facto decriminalization. And it simply means crime's going to pay.
A 1982 law deregulated the savings and loan industry.
And it kicked off a race to the bottom in regulation as the states and the federal government competed for who could have the weakest regulation.
Paola Sapienza teaches at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. She says there doesn't have to be any conspiracy to defraud regulators. People in government get paid less than top bankers, and they do know less about the financial industry's plumbing.
And so they could be intimidated by sentences like, you know, if you do regulate us, tomorrow the world will end.
Sapienza says that's a line that echoes from the 1980s to the more recent financial crisis and its aftermath. Roy Smith makes another connection. He teaches finance at NYU, and he spent much of the 1980s at Goldman Sachs.
You have to remember that this S&L crisis actually spawned two of our most, two of the financial industry's most lucrative product streams. One was the securitization of mortgages into mortgage-backed securities. Hello? Those things that blew up in 2008
were created for sale to savings and loans.
That was one of them. The other was the derivatives business got going.
He says it took more deregulation, time, and financial creativity for both products to cause problems. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
As part of our collaboration with the BBC on obesity, we've focused on access to fresh fruits and vegetables, on how unhealthy American food is exported to places like India, and on the rise of diabetes in China. Now, something a little different. How your food looks and smells, and how that makes us more likely to eat a lot of it or not. It's called neurogastronomy, and the BBC's Lucy Hooker is here to tell us all about it. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, David.
Talk to me a bit about this term, neurogastronomy. What does it mean?
It's all about scientists having a look at what's going on in our brains and our heads when we eat something. Now, there's been a lot of experimental gastronomy going on in the last few years. You guys have probably heard of Heston Blumenthal, a British chef who experiments with things like egg and bacon ice cream and playing the sounds of the sea in your ears while you're eating a seafood dish to make it fresher. Well, now scientists have kind of got hold of this idea and they're saying, well, what could we do? How far could we go with this? Is it just a kind of a toy in the restaurant, or does it make a big difference to what we experience, what we taste, if I change the lighting, the plate that it's served on, the sounds that I'm hearing, all of those other senses that play a part in the context of enjoying a great meal?
So this is something that scientists are studying, as you say, and certainly chefs at the vanguard of modernist cuisine are working with. Are food companies looking into this area of science as well?
Food companies are, and they're beginning to get really interested. They're a little bit cagey about talking about specific products that they've brought out. They don't necessarily want us to know what they're doing, but they are definitely researching it. So one of the experiments that they've done are conducted in a restaurant here in London, where they gave diners a dessert and they asked them to ring up a telephone line. They could choose one to hear a bitter sound to enhance the bitterness of the dessert. And I think I can play a bit of that for you now. Or if you chose, you could ring up and hear a sound to enhance the sweetness of the dessert. Now, I don't know if you can sense the difference there, David. You've probably not got anything to put in your mouth right now, but you could try it again later. Starbucks heard about that experiment when they said, we want in on this. They got a playlist of the kind of music you should listen to when you're drinking your coffee at home. So that was one example of a company that's picked up on this and taken it. But other, you know, lots of the really big food companies, Unilever, Nestle, all of these people have massive research and development units, and they are putting a lot of effort and a lot of focus into seeing how they can use our different senses, how they can combine the, you know, the sound that a food makes in our mouth, the sound of the packaging, the sight of it, the smell of it, all of those things in enhancing the taste experience.
Lucy Hooker is a business reporter for the BBC World Service. Thank you, Lucy.
It's a pleasure.
Coming up,
many families have less of their own cash to spend, maybe even at their own employer's stores.
The secret life of a food stamp, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 40 points, 0.2%, to end at 16,573. The NASDAQ gained 8 points, 0.2%, closing at 4,276. And the S&P 500 added 5 points, also 0.2%, finishing at a record 1,890. The Justice Department is bringing criminal charges against Pacific Gas and Electric, saying the utility knowingly violated pipeline safety laws. The charges stem from a natural gas explosion 4 years ago in San Bruno, California, that destroyed a neighborhood and killed 8 people. PG&E shares climbed 2.3%. European markets ticked up. Germany's DAX added 0.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.81%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee receives a closed briefing on Russia. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for February. And some folks observe National Find a Rainbow Day. Don't want to go outside? Just dig in your box of crayons. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. The food stamp program was written into law 50 years ago, but its use has really soared over the last decade. A record 1 in 7 Americans is currently on food stamps. As part of our special series called The Secret Life of a Food Stamp, we look today at how many of the same companies who receive billions of dollars in food stamp revenue also have hundreds of thousands of their own workers on food stamps. Here's Marketplace's wealth and poverty reporter, Chrissy Clark.
When you start to really focus on the way food stamp dollars flow through the economy, it can make your head spin. Take a moment like this one.
Quaker oatmeal, $2.50.
After her shift, a Walmart worker from Columbus, Ohio, named Stephanie Ballum.
Mini ravioli, 98 cents.
Buys a few groceries at Walmart. Some oatmeal, couple cans of ravioli.
Mini ravioli, 98 cents.
Some of which she might have put on the shelves herself. She swipes her employee ID card to get her store discount. And then, because the paycheck from her full-time job still lands her close to the poverty line,
insert cash or select payment type.
She pays for those groceries with her food stamp card. She punches in the card's PIN number and gets a receipt showing she spent a grand total of
$4.01.
$4.01 paid in food stamps that has just become revenue for Walmart. Ballum, who's 31 and has a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, is glad to have a job. She started getting food stamps when she was unemployed. But 3 years ago, when Walmart hired her, first as a temp, starting out at $7.25 an hour.
They told me how much I'd be making. I was like, it's like being punched. And I knew that I would still need those services.
I started wondering how typical Stephanie Ballum is. The federal government doesn't actually track how many workers at Walmart or any other company are on food stamps. But Ohio, where Stephanie Ballum lives, does keep a list of the 50 companies with the most workers and their family members on food stamps. There are lots of fast food chains and retail stores, McDonald's, Target, Kroger, Dollar General. At the very top of the list, in terms of sheer numbers of people, is Walmart. Last year, more than 14,000 Walmart employees and their family members used food stamps. If you do a little number crunching, that suggests that around 15% of the company's workforce in Ohio is on food stamps.
I think it's troubling that any American has to turn to a program like that, but the fact is they do.
David Tovar is vice president of communications for Walmart. I met him at the company headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, where the front hall is painted with big white letters that spell out the Walmart motto, save money, live better. He said it's important to put the number of Walmart employees on food stamps in perspective. Walmart is the largest employer in Ohio and in the U.S.
So, you know, we're representative of the country, in a lot of ways.
Including the country's growing rate of food stamp use, Tovar says, especially in the traditionally lower-paying retail and service sector.
We would love nothing more than a day when, you know, you didn't have to have programs like that. But for now, with the economy the way it is, with customers continuing to struggle the way they are, I think it's really important to be able to help people along the way and give them, relief during these periods of time.
Could Walmart, are there ever internal talks about, let's make the retail sector one where people don't need to supplement their incomes with food stamps?
I think retail jobs are good jobs, and I think they give people a lot of opportunities. you know, the retail sector, I think, is always going to have entry-level jobs.
Tovar went on to say something other Walmart executives have said before him.
It's really not where you start. I think it's where you end up.
But there was a time not so long ago when where you started, even an entry-level job, could afford you a much different life. And that difference is encapsulated in the work histories of a father and son from Dayton, Ohio.
I'm Adam Hudson, and this is my dad,
James Hudson.
Let's start with Adam. He's 21 years old, no college degree. Last summer, he got a job at a Walmart supercenter as a sales associate in the hardware department.
I'd always considered people who use food stamps to just take advantage of the government and weren't working hard enough to be able to afford for themselves.
But Adam saw lots of his coworkers working hard and using food stamps. And a few weeks after he started at Walmart, making $8.25 an hour, he enrolled in the program, too. His fiancée was pregnant, and he remembers one day they were hanging out after he got home from work.
And she had mentioned that she was hungry, hadn't been able to eat that day.
Hadn't been able to eat anything?
Not really. We didn't have much then. And it dawned on us that we can't afford to feed ourselves and make sure all of our bills are paid and have a car with gas to get to work every day.
I don't even know how you afford the gas.
That's James Hudson again, Adam's dad, 52 years old. Back when he was a young man, like Adam, starting a family with no college degree, he got a job at what was, back then, the largest employer in Ohio and the country. Not Walmart, but General Motors. I asked Jim what his wage was when he got that job building trucks in the early 90s.
Started out at $9.35 an hour.
Adam was shaking his head at this. What noise did you just make?
That was just kind of like a snort, because that's back then. I'm making like $8.25 now.
Adam would love a job at the GM factory where his dad worked, but it shut down in 2008. But back when GM still was Ohio's largest employer, it's worth pointing out that it would not have ranked as a top food stamp employer. Its wages were generally high enough, even its starting wages, that few of its workers would have qualified for food stamps at all.
No, they would not have. Those workers would have earned too much to qualify for the program.
James Ziliak is an economist at the University of Kentucky. He's been looking at the way food stamp enrollment has changed in the last 30 years, and the difference between Adam's job at Walmart and his dad's at GM kind of puts it in a nutshell. One of the starkest changes in the last few decades is the increase in working people, people who have steady jobs but earn so little they still need food stamps to get by. Ziliak says back when manufacturing was still king,
wages would grow, prices would grow, but wages would grow faster than prices.
And that was driving the consumer economy. Today, in an economy fueled by the retail and service industry, Ziliak says companies try to stay competitive by keeping prices down.
And one way to do that is to make sure their wages are kept in control. But it, you know, that also has a feedback effect that if wages aren't rising, many families have less of their own cash to spend, maybe even at their own employer's stores.
And that's where food stamps come in. People with low wages who have less money of their own to spend get help from the federal government to cover food expenses, which means they can spend a little more on other things, too. That helps those people, and it helps the stores where they shop and sometimes work. But as helpful as food stamps may be, as an economic stimulus, as support for low-wage jobs, when you talk to workers who've been on them, their feelings about food stamps can be complicated.
I'm not proud that I was on assistance, but I had to provide for my family, and I'm so thankful for my job now, because now I'm off of it.
Mary Burkett recently got hired as an assistant manager for a Walmart supercenter in Huber Heights, Ohio. Before that, she was a store manager at Dollar General, where an even higher percentage of workers are on food stamps than at Walmart. Mary Burkett was one of them. When she found out how much her new job at Walmart would pay her, $43,000 a year, she says she literally cut up her food stamp card.
I was so happy, so happy. I knew that I would be able to provide insurance for my kids. I'd be able to put food on the table, and I wouldn't need everything that I was on before.
Burkett is happy to have worked her way off food stamps. But for those who have not found a way, a certain resignation can set in when you're working and not getting ahead. Tara, who asked not to use her last name for fear of risking her job, has been at Walmart for 4 years and now makes $10 an hour. Her family was on food stamps when she started at Walmart, and they still are. She has friends who rant about food stamps, how they're a drain on taxpayer dollars, and she kind of agrees. But she says,
I don't really pay too much attention to them because I work for my food stamps.
And the way things stand now, a lot of people who work at Walmart and lots of other retail stores that take in billions in food stamp dollars are doing the same thing, working hard for low wages, signing up for food stamps, and paying them straight back into the cash register. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Check out the Secret Life of a Food Stamp series at marketplace.org, where you can also explore our Wage Wager Interactive, how to make ends meet on not much money. That's at marketplace.org, along with content from our series partner, Slate, and photos from Chrissy's reporting.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which I bring you this.
Warren Buffett here.
Hey, Warren. What are today's projections?
Yesterday's troll market really hurt us, but cats are up slightly today.
That's Warren Buffett in a video produced by his alma mater, the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where Buffett is advising the school's chancellor on what to tweet. Yeah, cats. Or better yet, a video with Warren Buffett talking about cats. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 40 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ gained 8 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 added 5 points, also 0.2%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the program for us. I'm David Gura. See you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.